three remained in King's Landing, Lord Peake, Lord Mouton, and Grand Maester Monken, who came rushing back inside the Red Keep, the moment Sir Robert Darklyn commanded that its gates be opened once again. Manfred Mouton was bedridden, still recovering his strength after his battle with the fever, and asked that any decisions be postponed until Lady Jane Arryn and Lord Royce Carron could be summoned back from the Vale and the Dornish Marches to take part in the deliberations. His colleagues would have none of it, however, Lord Peake insisting that the former regents had given up their places on the council by departing King's Landing. With the Grand Maester's support, Monken would later come to rue his acquiescence, Unwin Peake then set aside all of the king's appointments and arrangements, on the grounds that no boy of 12 had the judgment to decide such weighty matters himself. Marston Waters was confirmed as Lord Commander of the King's Guard, whilst Darklyn and Massey were commanded to surrender their white cloaks, so that Sir Marston might bestow them on knights of his own choosing. Grand Maester Orwell was returned to his cell to await execution. So as not to offend Lord Rowan, the regents offered him a place amongst them and the office of Justiciar and Master of Laws. No similar gesture was made to Alan Valerian, but of course there was no question of such a boy of his years and of such uncertain lineage serving as Lord Admiral. The offices of King's Hand and Protector of the Realm, previously separate, were now combined, and filled by none other than Unwin Peake himself. Mushroom tells us that King Aegon III reacted to the decisions of his regents with a sullen silence, speaking only once, to protest the dismissal of Massey and Darklyn. "Kingsguard serve for life," the boy said, to which Lord Peake replied, "Only when they have been properly appointed, Your Grace." Elsewise, Septon Eustace tells us, the king received the decrees courteously and thanked Lord Peake for his wisdom, as, "I am still a boy, as your lordship knows, and in want of instruction in these matters." If his true feelings were otherwise, Aegon did not choose to voice them, but instead retreated back into silence and passivity. For the remainder of his minority, King Aegon III took little part in the rule of his realm, save for fixing his signature and seal upon such papers as Lord Peake presented him. On certain formal occasions his grace would be brought out to sit the Iron Throne or welcome an envoy, but elsewise he was little seen inside the Red Keep, and never beyond its walls. It behooves us now to pause for a moment and turn our gaze upon Unwin Peake, who would rule the Seven Kingdoms in all but name for the best part of 3 years, serving as Lord Regent, Protector of the Realm, and Hand of the King. His house was amongst the oldest in the Reach, its deep roots twisting back to the Age of Heroes and the First Men. Amongst his many illustrious ancestors, his lordship could count such legends as Sir Urthon the Shield Smasher, Lord Merrin the Scribe, Lady Irmer of the Golden Bowl, Sir Barquin the Besieger, Lord Edison the Elder, Lord Edison the Younger, and Lord Emmerich the Avenger. Many Peaks had served as councillors at Highgarden when the Reach was the richest and most powerful kingdom in all Westeros. When the pride and power of House Manderly became overweening, it was Lorimar Peake who humbled them and drove them into exile in the north, for which service King Percion III Gardener granted him the former Manderly seat at Dunstanbury and its attendant lands. King Percion's son Gwaen took Lord Lorimar's daughter as his bride as well, making her the seventh Peake maiden to sit beneath the Green Hand as Queen of all the Reach. Through the centuries, other daughters of House Peake had married Redwines, Rowans, Costains, Oakharts, Osgrays, Florence, even Hightowers. All this had ended with the coming of the dragons. Lord Armand Peake and his sons had perished on the Field of Fire, beside King Nern and his. With House Gardener extinguished, Aegon the Conqueror had granted Highgarden and the rule of the Reach to House Tyrell, the former royal stewards. The Tyrells had no blood ties to the Peaks and no reason to favour them, and thus the slow fall of this proud house had begun. A century later, the Peaks still held three castles, and their lands were wide and well-peopled, if not particularly rich, but no longer did they command pride of place amongst the bannermen of Highgarden. Unwin Peake was determined to redress that and restore House Peake to its former greatness. Like his father, who had sided with the majority at the Great Council of 101, he did not believe it was a woman's place to rule over men. During the Dance of the Dragons, Lord Unwin had been amongst the fiercest of the Greens, leading forth 1,000 swords and spears to keep Aegon II on the Iron Throne. When Ormond Hightower fell at Tumbleton, Lord Unwin believed command of his host should have come to him, but this was denied him by scheming rivals. This he never forgave, stabbing the turncloak Owain Boany and plotting the murders of the dragon riders Hugh Hammer and Ulf White. Foremost of the Caltrops, though this was not widely known, and one of only three still living, Lord Unwin had proved at Tumbleton that he was no man to trifle with. He would prove that again in King's Landing. Having elevated Sir Marston Waters to command of the King's Guard, Lord Peak now prevailed upon him to confer white cloaks on two of his own kin, his nephew, Sir Amory Peak of Starpike, and his bastard brother, Sir Mervyn Flowers. The city watch was placed under the command of Sir Lucas Laygood, the son of one of the Caltrops who had died at Tumbleton. To replace the men who had died during the winter fever in the Moon of Madness, the hand bestowed gold cloaks on 500 of his own men. Lord Peak did not have a trusting nature, and all he had seen and been a part of at Tumbleton had convinced him that his enemies would bring him down if given half a chance. Ever mindful of his own safety, he surrounded himself with his own personal guard, 10 sellswords loyal only to him, and the gold he lavished on them, who in due course became known as his fingers. Their captain, a Volantine adventurer named Tassario, had tiger stripes tattooed across his face and back, the marks of a slave soldier. Men called him Tassario the Tiger to his face, which pleased him. Behind his back, they called him Tassario the Thumb, the mocking sobriquet that Mushroom had bestowed upon him. Once secure in his own person, the new hand began bringing his own supporters, kin, and friends to court, in place of men and women whose loyalty was less assured. His widowed aunt, Clarice Osgray, was put in charge of Queen Yehera's household, supervising her maids and servants. Sir Gareth Long, Master-at-Arms at Starpike, was granted the same title at the Red Keep, and tasked with training King Aegon for knighthood. George Graceford, Lord of Holyhall, and Sir Victor Risley, Knight of Risley Glade, the sole surviving Caltrops aside from Lord Peak himself, were appointed Lord Confessor and King's Justice, respectively. The hand even went so far as to dismiss Septon Eustace, bringing in a younger man, Septon Bernard, to tend to the spiritual needs of the court and supervise his grace's religious and moral instruction. Bernard, too, was of his blood, being descended from a younger sister of his great-grandsire. Once relieved of his duties, Septon Eustace departed King's Landing for Stony Sept, the town of his birth, where he devoted himself to the writing of his great, if somewhat turgid, work, The Reign of King Viserys, first of his name, and the Dance of the Dragons that came after. Sadly, Septon Bernard preferred composing sacred music to setting down court gossip, and his writings are therefore of little interest to historians and scholars, and of less interest to those who find pleasure in sacred music, it grieves us to say. None of these changes pleased the young king. His grace was especially unhappy with his king's guard. He neither liked nor trusted the two new men, and had not forgotten the presence of Sir Marston Waters at his mother's death. King Aegon misliked the hand's fingers even more, if that is possible, especially their brash and foul-mouthed commander, Tassario the Thumb. That mislike turned to hatred when the Volantine slew Sir Robin Massey, one of the young knights that Aegon had wished to name to his king's guard, in a quarrel over a horse both men wished to buy. The king soon developed a strong antipathy for his new master-at-arms as well. Sir Gareth Long was a skilled swordsman but a stern taskmaster, renowned at Starpike for his harshness toward the boys he instructed. Those who did not meet his standards were made to go for days without sleep, doused in tubs of iced water, had their heads shaved, and were oft beaten. None of these punishments were available to Sir Gareth in his new position. Though Aegon was a sullen student who displayed little interest in swordplay or the arts of war, his royal person was inviolate. Whenever Sir Gareth spoke to him too loudly or too harshly, the king would simply throw down his sword and shield and walk away. Aegon seemed to have only one companion he cared about. Gaemon Palehair, his 6-year-old cupbearer and food taster, not only shared all of the king's meals but oft accompanied him to the yard, as Sir Gareth did not fail to note. As a bastard born of a whore, Gaemon counted for little in the court, so when Sir Gareth asked Lord Peake to make the lad the king's whipping boy, the hand was pleased to do so. Thereafter, any misbehaviour, laziness, or truculence on King Aegon's part resulted in punishment for his friend. Gaemon's blood and Gaemon's tears reached the king as none of Gareth Long's words ever had, and his grace's improvement was soon marked by every man who watched him in the castle yard. But the king's mislike of his teacher only deepened. Tyland Lannister, blind and crippled, had always treated the king with deference, speaking to him gently, seeking to guide rather than command. Unwin Peake made a sterner hand. Brusque and hard, he showed little patience with the young monarch, treating him more like a sulky boy than like a king, in Mushroom's words, and making no effort to involve his grace in the day-to-day rule of his kingdom. When Aegon III retreated back into silence, solitude, and a brooding passivity, his hand was pleased to ignore him, save on certain formal occasions when his presence was required. Rightly or wrongly, Sir Tyland Lannister was perceived as having been a weak and ineffectual hand, yet somehow also sinister, scheming, even monstrous. Lord Unwin Peake came to the handship determined to demonstrate his strength and rectitude. "This hand is not blind, nor veiled, nor crippled," he announced before king and court. "This hand can still wield a sword." And so saying, he drew his long sword from its scabbard and raised it high so all might see it. Whispers flew about the hall. It was no common blade that his lordship held, but one forged of Valyrian steel. Orphan maker, last seen in the hands of bold John Roxton as he laid about at Hardhugh Hammer's men in a yard at Tumbleton. The feast day of our Father Above is a most propitious day for making judgments, the Septons teach us. In 133 AC, the new hand decreed that it should be a day when those who had previously been judged would at last be punished for their crimes. The city jails were crowded to bursting, and even the deep dungeons below the Red Keep were near full. Lord Unwin emptied them. The prisoners were marched or dragged out to the square before the Red Keep's gates, where thousands of Kingslanders gathered to see them receive their due. With the sombre young king and his stern hand looking down from the battlements, the king's justice set to work. As there was too much work for one sword alone, Tessario the Thumb and his fingers were tasked with aiding him. "It would have gone more quickly if the hand had sent to the Street of Flies for butchers," Mushroom observes, "for it was butchers' work they were about, hacking and cleaving. 40 thieves had their hands removed. 8 rapers were gelded, then marched naked to the riverside with their genitals hung about their necks to be put aboard ships for the war. A suspected poor fellow who preached that the 7 sent the winter fever to punish House Targaryen for incest had his tongue removed. 2 pox-riddled whores were mutilated in unspeakable ways for passing the pox to dozens of men. 6 servants found guilty of stealing from their masters had their noses slit. A 7th, who cut a hole in a wall to peek upon his master's daughters in their nakedness, had the offending eye plucked out as well. Next came the murderers. 7 were brought forth, 1 an innkeep who had been killing certain of his guests, those he judged would not be missed, and stealing their valuables since the old king's time. Where the other murderers were hanged straight away, he had his hands hacked off and burned before his eyes. Then he was hung by a noose and disemboweled as he strangled. Last came the 3 most prominent prisoners, the ones that the mob had been waiting for. Yet another shepherd reborn. The captain of a Pentoshi merchantman who had been accused and found guilty of bringing the winter fever from Sisterton to King's Landing. And the former Grand Maester Orwell, a convicted traitor and a deserter from the Night's Watch. The King's Justice, Sir Victor Risley, attended to each of them himself. He removed the heads of the Pentoshi and the False Shepherd with his headsman's axe. But Grand Maester Orwell was granted the honour of dying by the sword, in view of his age, high birth, and long service. When our father's feast was done, and the mob before the gates dispersed, the King's hand was well satisfied, wrote Septon Eustace, who would depart for Stony Sept the next day. Would that I could write that the small folk returned to their homes and hovels to fast and pray, and beg forgiveness for their own sins, but that would be far from the truth. Flush with blood, they sought out dens of sin instead, and the city's alehouses, wine-sinks, and brothels were crowded unto bursting, for such is the wickedness of men. Mushroom says the same, though in his own way. Whenever I see a man put to death, I like to have a flagon and a woman afterward, to remind myself that I am still alive. King Aegon III stood atop the gatehouse battlements throughout the feast of our father above, and never spoke nor looked away from the bloodletting below. The king had as well been made of wax, observed Septon Eustace. Grand Maester Monken echoes him. His grace was present, as was his duty, yet somehow he seemed far away as well. Some of the condemned turned to the battlements to shout out cries for mercy, but the king never seemed to see them, nor hear their desperate words. Make no mistake, this feast was served to us by the hand, and 'twas he who gorged upon it. By mid-year the castle, city, and king were all firmly in the grasp of the new hand. The small folk were quiet. The winter fever had receded. Queen Jehera hid in seclusion in her chambers. King Aegon trained in the yard by morning and stared at the stars by night. Beyond the walls of King's Landing, however, the woes that had afflicted the realm these past 2 years had only worsened. Trade had withered away to nothing. War continued in the west. Famine and fever ruled much of the north, and to the south the Dornish men were growing bolder and more troublesome. It was past time the Iron Throne showed its power, Lord Peak decided. Construction had been completed on 8 of the 10 great warships commissioned by Sir Tyland, so the hand resolved to begin by opening the narrow sea to trade once more. To command the royal fleet, he tapped another uncle, Sir Gedmund Peake, a seasoned battler known as Gedmund Greataxe for his favoured weapon. Though justly renowned for his prowess as a warrior, Sir Gedmund had little knowledge or experience of ships, however, so his lordship also summoned the notorious Sellsail, Ned Bean, called Black Bean for his thick black beard, to serve as the Great Axe's second-in-command and advise him on all matters nautical. The situation in the Stepstones, as Sir Gedmund and Black Bean set sail, was chaotic, to say the least. Recalio Rindoon's ships had been swept from the sea for the most part, but he still ruled Bloodstone, largest of the islands, and a few smaller rocks. The Tyroshi had been on the point of overwhelming him when Lys and Myr had made peace and launched a joint attack on Tyrosh, forcing the Archon to recall his ships and swords. The three-headed alliance of Braavos, Pentos, and Lorath had lost one of its heads with the withdrawal of the Lorathi, but the Pentoshi cell swords now held all the stepstones not in the hands of Recalio's men, and the Braavosi warships owned the waters between. Westeros could not hope to prevail in a sea war against Braavos, Lord Unwin knew. His purpose, he declared, was to put an end to the rogue Recalio Rindoon and his piratical kingdom, and establish a presence upon Bloodstone, to ensure that never again could the narrow sea be closed. The royal fleet, comprised of the 8 new warships and some 20 older cogs and galleys, was nowise large enough to accomplish this, so the hand wrote to Driftmark, instructing the Lord of the Tides to gather your Lord Grandsire's fleets and put them under the command of our good Uncle Gedmund, so that he may open the sea roads once again. This was no more than Alyn Valerian had long desired, as the sea snake had before him, though when he read the message the young lord bristled and declared, they are my fleets now, and Baylor's monkey is more suited to command them than Uncle Gedmund. Even so, he did as he was bid, bringing together 60 war galleys, 30 longships and more than 100 cogs and great cogs to meet the royal fleet as it swept out from King's Landing. As the great war fleet passed through the gullet, Sir Gedmund sent over Blackbeam to Lord Alan's flagship, Queen Rhaenys, with a letter authorizing him to take command of the Valerian squadrons, so that they may benefit from his many years of experience. Lord Alan sent him back. "I would have hanged him," he wrote to Sir Gedmund, "but I am loath to waste good hempen rope on a bean." In winter, strong north winds oft prevail upon the narrow sea, so the fleet made splendid time on its voyage south. Off Tarth, another dozen longships rowed out to further swell their ranks, commanded by Lord Brindamere, the Evenstar. The tidings that his lordship brought proved less welcome, however. The Sea Lord of Braavos, the Archon of Tyrosh, and Recalio Rin Dune had made common cause. They would rule the Stepstones jointly, and only such ships as were licensed to trade by Braavos or Tyrosh would be allowed to pass. "What of Pentos?" Lord Alan wanted to know. "Discarded," the Evenstar informed him. "A pie split three ways offers larger slices than one cut into quarters." Gedmund Greataxe, who had been so seasick during the voyage that the sailors had named him Gedmund Greensick, decided that the king's hand should be informed of this new alignment amongst the warring cities. The Evenstar had already sent a raven to King's Landing, so Peake decreed that the fleet would remain at Tarth until a reply was received. "That will lose us any hope of taking Recalio by surprise," argued Alan Valerian, but Sir Gedmund proved adamant. The two commanders parted angrily. The next day, when the sun rose, Blackbean woke Sir Gedmund to inform him that the Lord of the Tides was gone. The entire Valerian fleet had slipped off during the night. Gedmund Greataxe snorted. "Run back to Driftmark, I'd venture," he said. Ned Bean agreed, calling Lord Alan a scared boy. They could not have been more wrong. Lord Alan had taken his ships south, not north. 3 days later, whilst Gedmund Greataxe and his royal fleet still lingered off the coast of Tarth waiting on a raven, battle was joined amongst the rocks, sea stacks, and tangled waterways of the Stepstones. The attack caught the Braavosi unawares, with their Grand Admiral and 20 of his captains feasting on bloodstone with Recalio Rin Dune and the envoys from Tyrosh. Half of the Braavosi ships were taken, burned, or sunk, while still at anchor or tied to a dock, others as they raised sail and tried to get underway. The fight was not entirely bloodless. The Grand Defiance, a towering Braavosi Drummond of 400 oars, fought her way past half a dozen smaller Valerian warships to gain the open sea, only to find Lord Alan himself bearing down on her. Too late, the Braavosi tried to turn to face her attacker, but the huge Drummond was ponderous in the water and slow to answer, and Queen Rhaenys struck her broadside with every oar churning water. The Queen's prow smashed into the side of the great Braavosi ship, like a great oaken fist, one observer wrote later, splintering her oars, crashing through her planks and hull, toppling her masts, cutting the massive Drummond almost in two. When Lord Alan shouted to his rowers to back them off, the sea rushed into the gaping wound the Queen had made, and the Grand Defiance went down in mere moments. And with it, the Sea Lord's swollen pride. Alan Valerian's victory was complete. He lost 3 ships in the Stepstones. One, sadly, was the True Heart, captained by his cousin Daron, who perished when she sank, whilst sinking more than 30 and capturing 6 galleys, 11 cogs, 89 hostages, vast amounts of food, drink, arms, and coin, and an elephant meant for the Sea Lord's menagerie. All this the Lord of the Tides brought back to Westeros, along with a name that he would carry for the rest of his life, Oakenfist. When Lord Alan sailed Queen Rhaenys up the Blackwater Rush and rode in through the river gate on the back of the Sea Lord's elephant, tens of thousands lined the city streets, shouting his name and clamouring for a glimpse of their new hero. At the gates of the Red Keep, King Aegon III himself appeared to welcome him. Once within the walls, however, it was a different story. By the time Alan Oakenfist reached the throne room, the young king had somehow vanished. Instead, Lord Unwin Peake scowled down at him from atop the Iron Throne and said, "You fool! You thrice-damned fool! If I dared, I would have your bloody head off!" The Hand had good cause to be so wroth. However loudly the mob might cheer for Oakenfist, their bold young hero's rash attack had left the realm in an untenable position. Lord Valerian might have captured a score of Bravosi's ships and an elephant, but he had not taken Bloodstone, nor any of the other stepstones. The knights and men-at-arms such a conquest would have required had been aboard the larger ships of the royal fleet that he abandoned off the shores of Tarth. The destruction of Recalio Rindoon's pirate kingdom had been Lord Peak's objective. Instead, Recalio appeared to have emerged stronger than ever. The last thing the Hand desired was war with Braavos, richest and most powerful of the 9 free cities. "Yet that is what you have given us, my lord," Peak thundered. "You have given us a war!" "And an elephant," Lord Allen answered insolently. "Pray do not forget the elephant, my lord." The remark drew nervous titters even from Lord Peak's own hand-picked men, Mushroom tells us. But the Hand was not amused. "He was not a man who liked to laugh himself," the dwarf says, "and he liked being laughed at even less." Though other men might fear to provoke Lord Unwin's enmity, Allan Oakenfist was secure in his own strength. Though barely a man grown, and bastard-born as well, he was wed to the king's half-sister, had all the power and wealth of House Valerian at his command, and had just become the darling of the small folk. Lord Regent or no, Unwin Peak was not so mad as to imagine he could safely harm the hero of the Stepstones. "All young men suspect they are immortal," Grand Maester Munken writes in The True Telling, "and whenever a young warrior tastes the heady wine of victory, suspicion becomes certainty. Yet the confidence of youth counts for little against the cunning of age. Lord Allen might smile at the Hand's rebukes, but he would soon be given good reason to dread the Hand's rewards." Munken knew whereof he wrote. 7 days after the triumphant return of Lord Allen to King's Landing, he was honoured in a lavish ceremony in the Red Keep, with King Aegon III seated on the Iron Throne and the court and half the city looking on. Sir Marston Waters, Lord Commander of the King's Guard, dubbed him a knight. Unwin Peak, Lord Regent and Hand of the King, draped an admiral's golden chain about his neck and presented him with a silver replica of the Queen Rhaenys as a token of his victory. The king himself inquired if his lordship would consent to serve upon his small council as master of ships. Lord Allen humbly agreed. "Then the Hand's fingers closed about his throat," says Mushroom. "The voice was Aegon's, the words Unwin's." His leal subjects in the West had long been troubled by reavers from the Iron Islands, the young king declared. And who better to bring peace to the Sunset Sea than his new admiral? And Allan Oakenfist, that proud and headstrong youth, found he had no choice but to agree to sail his fleets around the southern end of Westeros to win back Fair Isle and end the menace of Lord Dalton Greyjoy and his Iron Man. The trap was neatly set. The voyage was perilous and like to take a heavy toll of the Valerian fleets. The Stepstones teemed with enemies who would not be taken unawares a second time. Past them lay the barren coasts of Dorne, where Lord Allen was not like to find safe harbour. And should he gain the Sunset Sea, he would find the Red Kraken waiting with his longships. If the Iron Men prevailed, the power of House Valerian would be broken for good and all, and Lord Peak need never again suffer the insolence of the boy called Oakenfist. If Lord Allen triumphed, Fair Isle would be restored to its true lords, the Westlands would be freed from further outrage, and the lords of the 7 kingdoms would learn the price of defying King Aegon III and his new hand. The Lord of the Tides made a gift of his elephant to King Aegon III as he took his leave of King's Landing. Returning to Hull to gather his fleet and take on provisions for the long journey, he said his farewells to his wife, the Lady Bela, who sent him on his way with a kiss, and the news that she was with child. "Name him Corlys, after my grandsire," Lord Allen told her. "One day he may sit the Iron Throne." Bela laughed at that. "I will name her Lena, after my mother. One day she may ride a dragon." Lord Corlys Valerian had made 9 famous voyages on his sea snake, it will be recalled. Lord Allan Oakenfist would make 6 upon 6 different ships. "My ladies," he would call them. On his voyage round Dorne to Lannisport, he sailed a Bravose war galley of 200 oars, captured in the Stepstones and renamed the Lady Bela after his young wife. Some might think it queer for Lord Peak to send off the largest fleet in the Seven Kingdoms, whilst war with Bravos threatened. Sir Gedmund Peak and the royal fleet had been recalled from Tarth to the Gullet to guard the entrance to Blackwater Bay should the Bravose seek to retaliate against King's Landing. But other ports and cities all up and down the Narrow Sea remained vulnerable. So the King's Hand dispatched fellow regent, Lord Manfred Mouton, to Bravos to treat with the Sea Lord and return his elephant. Six other noble lords accompanied him, along with 60 knights, guardsmen, servants, scribes and septons, 6 singers, and Mushroom, who supposedly hid in a wine cask to escape the gloom of the Red Keep and find a place where men remembered how to laugh. Then as now, the Bravosi were a pragmatic people, for theirs is a city of escaped slaves where 1,000 false gods are honoured, but only gold is truly worshipped. Profit means more than pride amongst the Hundred Isles. Upon arrival, Lord Mouton and his companions marvelled at the Titan, and were taken to the fabled arsenal to witness the building of a warship, completed in a single day. "We have already replaced every ship that your boy Admiral stole or sank," the Sea Lord boasted to Lord Mouton. Having thus demonstrated the power of Bravos, however, he was more than willing to be placated. Whilst he haggled with Lord Mouton over terms of peace, Lords Follard and Cressy spread lavish bribes amongst the city's keyholders, magisters, priests and merchant princes. In the end, in return for a very sizable indemnity, Bravos forgave Lord Valerian's unwarranted transgression, agreed to dissolve her alliance with Tyrosh and break all ties with Recalio Rindun, and ceded the Stepstones to the Iron Throne. Since the islands were held by Rindun and the Pentoshi at this time, the Sea Lord had in effect sold something that he did not own. But this was not unusual in Bravos. The mission to Bravos proved eventful in other ways as well. Lord Follard became enamoured of a Bravosi courtesan, and elected to remain close to her rather than return to Westeros. Sir Herman Rollingford was killed in a duel by a Bravo who took offence at the colour of his doublet. And Sir Dennis Hart supposedly engaged the services of the mysterious Faceless Men to kill a rival back in King's Landing, Mushroom asserts. The fool himself so amused the Sea Lord that he received a handsome offer to remain in Bravos. "I do confess that I was tempted. In Westeros my wit is wasted capering for a king who never smiles. But in Bravos they would love me. Too well, I fear. Every courtesan would want me. And soon or late some bravo would take umbrage at the size of my member and prick me with his little pointy dwarf skewer. So back to the Red Keep Mushroom scurried, and more fool me." So it came to pass that Lord Mouton returned to King's Landing with peace in hand, but at a grievous cost. The huge indemnity demanded by the Sea Lord so depleted the royal treasury that Lord Peak soon found it necessary to borrow from the Iron Bank of Bravos, just so the crown might pay its debts. And that in turn required him to reinstate certain of Lord Keltigar's taxes that Sir Tyland Lannister had abolished, which angered lords and merchants alike, and weakened his support amongst the small folk. The last half of the year proved calamitous in other ways as well. The court rejoiced when Lady Rhaena announced that she was with child by Lord Corbray, but joy turned to grief a moon's turn later when she miscarried. Widespread famine was reported in the north, and the winter fever descended on Barrowton, the first time it had ever travelled so far inland. A raider named Silas the Grim led 3,000 wildlings against the wall, overwhelming the Black Brothers at Queensgate and spreading out across the Gift until Lord Cregan Stark rode forth from Winterfell, joined with the Glovers of Deepwood Mott, the Flints and Norries of the Hills, and 100 rangers from the Night's Watch, to hunt them down and put an end to them. 1,000 leagues to the south, Sir Stephen Connington was hunting too, pursuing a small band of Dornish raiders across the windswept marches. But he rode too far and too fast, ignorant of what lay ahead, until one-armed Wyland Will came down on him and Lady Elenda found herself widowed once again. In the west, Lady Joanna Lannister hoped to follow her victory at Case by striking another blow against the Red Kraken. Assembling a ragtag fleet of fishing boats and cogs beneath the walls of feast fires, she loaded 100 knights and 3,000 men-at-arms aboard, and sent them out to sea under the cover of darkness to retake Fair Isle from the Iron Man. The plan was to land them undetected on the south end of the island, but someone had betrayed them, and the longships were waiting. Lord Prester, Lord Tarbeck, and Sir Erwin Lannister commanded the ill-fated crossing. Dalton Greyjoy sent their heads to Casterly Rock afterward, calling it payment for my uncle, though in truth he was a glutton and a drunkard, and the islands are well rid of him. Yet all these were as naught against the tragedy that descended on the court and king. On the 22nd day of the 9th moon of 133 AC, Jaehaera of House Targaryen, Queen of the Seven Kingdoms and the last surviving child of King Aegon II, perished at the age of 10. The little queen died just as her mother, Queen Helena, had, throwing herself from a window in Maegor's Holdfast onto the iron spikes that lined the dry moat below. Impaled through breast and belly, she twisted in agony for half an hour before she could be lifted free, whereupon she passed from this life at once. King's Landing grieved, as only King's Landing could. Jaehaera had been a frightened child, and from the day she donned her crown, she had hidden herself away inside the Red Keep. Yet the small folk of the city remembered her wedding, and how brave and beautiful the little girl had seemed, and so they wept and wailed and tore their clothes and crowded into septs and taverns and brothels to seek for whatever solace they could find. There the whispers soon were flying, just as they had when Queen Helena died in similar fashion. Had the little queen truly taken her own life? Even inside the walls of the Red Keep, speculation was rampant. Jaehaera was a lonely child, prone to weeping and somewhat simple-minded. Yet she had seemed content in her own chambers with her maids and ladies, her kittens and her dolls. What could have made her mad enough or sad enough to leap from her window onto those cruel spikes? Some suggested that Lady Rhaena's miscarriage might have made her so distraught she did not wish to live. Others, of a more cynical bent, countered that it might have been jealousy over the child growing inside of Lady Bela that drove her to the act. It was the king, whispered still others. She loved him with all her heart, yet he paid her no mind, showed her no affection, did not even share his rooms with her. And, of course, there were many who refused to believe that Jaehaera had taken her own life. She was murdered, they whispered, just as her mother was. But if that were true, who was the murderer? There was no lack of suspects. By tradition, there was always a knight of the king's guard posted at the queen's door. It would have been a simple thing for him to slip inside and throw the child from her window. If so, surely the king himself had given the command. Aegon had tired of her weeping and wailing and wanted a new wife, men said. Or perhaps he wished to revenge himself on the daughter of the king who killed his mother. The boy was dour and gloomy. No one truly knew his nature. Tales of Maegor the Cruel were freely told. Others blamed one of the little queen's companions, Lady Cassandra Baratheon. The eldest of the Four Storms, Lady Cassandra had been briefly betrothed to King Aegon II during the last year of his life, and possibly to his brother Aemond One-Eye before that. Disappointment had turned her sour, her detractors said. Once her father's heir at Storm's End, she found herself of little account in King's Landing, and bitterly resented having to care for the weepy, feeble-witted child queen whom she blamed for all her woes. One of the queen's bedmaids also came under suspicion when it was found that she had stolen two of Jaehaera's dolls and a pearl necklace. A serving boy who had spilled soup on the little queen the year before and been beaten for it was accused. Both of these were put to question by the Lord Confessor and finally declared innocent, though the boy died under questioning and the girl lost a hand for theft. Even holy servants of the Seven were not above suspicion. A certain scepter in the city had once been heard to say that the little queen ought never to have children, for simple-minded women produce simple-minded sons. The gold cloaks brought her in as well, and she vanished into a dungeon. Grief makes men mad. With hindsight, we can say for a fair certainty that none of these played any role in the sad death of the little queen. If indeed Jaehaera Targaryen was murdered, and there is no shred of proof of that. It was surely done at the behest of the only truly plausible culprit. Unwin Peak, Lord Regent, Lord of Starpike, Lord of Dunstanbury, Lord of Whitegrove, Protector of the Realm, and Hand of the King. Lord Peak was known to have shared his predecessor's concerns about the succession. Aegon III had no children, nor any living siblings, so far as it was known, and any man with eyes could see that the king was not like to get an heir from his little queen. Unless he did, the king's half-sisters remained his nearest kin, but Lord Peak was not about to allow a woman to ascend the Iron Throne, after having so recently fought and bled to prevent that very thing. If either of the twins produced a son, to be sure the boy would at once become first in the order of succession. But Lady Rhaena's pregnancy had ended in miscarriage, which left only the child growing inside Lady Bela on Driftmark. The thought that the crown might pass to the whelp of a wanton and a bastard was more than Lord Unwin Peak was prepared to stomach. Were the king to sire an heir of his own body, that calamity might be averted. But before that could happen, Jehera had to be removed so Aegon could remarry. Lord Peak could not have pushed the child from the window himself, to be sure, as he was elsewhere in the city when she died. But the king's guard, posted at the queen's door that night, was Mervyn Flowers, his bastard brother. Could he have been the hand's catspaw? It is more than possible, particularly in light of later events, which we shall discuss in due course. Bastard born himself, Sir Mervyn was regarded by most a dutiful, if not especially heroic, member of the King's Guard. Neither champion nor hero, but a seasoned soldier and a fair hand with a long sword. A leal man who did as he was told. Not all men are as they seem, however, particularly in King's Landing. Those who knew Flowers best saw other sides of him. When not on duty, he was fond of wine, says Mushroom, who was known to have drunk with him. Though sworn to chastity, he seldom slept alone, save in his cell at White Sword Tower. Despite being somewhat ill-favoured, he had a rough charm that washerwomen and serving-girls responded to, and when in his cups he would even boast of having bedded certain high-born ladies. Like many bastards, he was hot of blood and quick to anger, seeing slights where none had been intended. Yet none of this suggested that Flowers was the sort of monster who could take a sleeping child from her bed and throw her to a grisly death. Even Mushroom, ever ready to think the worst of everyone, says as much. If Sir Mervyn had killed the queen, he would have done it with a pillow, the fool insists, before suggesting a far more sinister and likely possibility. Flowers would never have pushed the queen out that window, the dwarf claims, but he might well have stood aside to allow someone else to enter her room, if that someone were known to him. Someone, mayhaps, like Tessario the Thumb, or one of the Fingers. Nor would Flowers have felt the need to ask their business with the little queen, not if they said they came at the hand's behest. So says the fool, but to be sure, all of this is fancy. The true tale of how Jehera Targaryen met her end will never be known. Mayhaps she did take her own life in some fit of childish despair. If murder was indeed the cause of her demise, however, for all these reasons, the man behind it could only have been Lord Unwin Peak. Yet without proof, none of this would have been damning, if not for what the hand did afterward. 7 days after the body of the little queen was consigned to the flames, Lord Unwin paid a call upon the grieving king, accompanied by Grand Maester Munken, Septon Bernard, and Marston Waters of the King's Guard. They had come to inform his grace that he must put aside his mourning blacks and wed again, for the good of the realm. Moreover, his new queen had been chosen for him. Unwin Peak had married thrice and sired 7 children. Only one survived. His firstborn son had died in infancy, as had both of his daughters by his second wife. His eldest daughter had lived long enough to marry, only to die in childbirth at the age of 12. His second son had been fostered on the Arbour, where he served Lord Redwine as page and squire, but at the age of 12 he had drowned in a sailing mishap. Sir Titus, heir to Starpike, was the only one of Lord Unwin's sons to grow to manhood. Knighted for valour after the Battle of the Honeywine by bold John Roxton, he had died only 6 days later, in a meaningless skirmish with a band of broken men he stumbled on whilst scouting. The hands last surviving child, was a daughter, Myriel. Myriel Peak was to be Aegon III's new queen. She was the ideal choice, the hand declared, the same age as the king, a lovely girl and courteous, born of one of the noblest houses in the realm, schooled by scepters to read, write, and do sums. Her lady mother had been fertile, so there was no reason to think that Myriel would not give his grace strong sons. "What if I do not like her?" King Aegon said. "You do not need to like her," Lord Peak replied. "You need only wed her, bed her, and father a son on her." Then, infamously, he added, "Your grace does not like turnips, but when your cooks prepare them, you eat them, do you not?" King Aegon nodded sullenly. But the tale got out, as such tales always do, and the unfortunate Lady Myriel was soon known as Lady Turnips throughout the Seven Kingdoms. She would never be Queen Turnips. Unwin Peak had overreached himself. Thaddeus Rowan and Manfred Mouton were outraged that he had not seen fit to consult them. Matters of such import rightly belonged to the Council of Regents. Lady Arryn sent a waspish note from the Vale. Kermit Tully declared the betrothal presumptuous. Ben Blackwood questioned the haste of it. Aegon should have been allowed half a year at least to mourn his little queen. A curt missive arrived from Cregan Stark in Winterfell, suggesting that the North might look with disfavour on such a match. Even Grand Maester Monken began to waver. "Lady Myriel is a delightful girl, and I have no doubt that she would make a splendid queen," he told the Hand. "But we must be concerned with appearances, my lord. We who have the honour of serving with your lordship know that you love his grace as if he were your own son, and do all you do for him and for the realm. But others may imply that you chose your daughter for more ignoble reasons, for power, or the glory of House Peak." Mushroom, our wise fool, observes that there are certain doors best not opened, for you never know what might come through. Peak had opened a queen's door for his daughter. But other lords had daughters too, as well as sisters, nieces, cousins, and even the odd widowed mother or maiden aunt. And before the door could close, they all came pushing through, insisting that their own blood would make a better royal consort than Lady Turnips. To recount all the names put forward would take more pages than we have, but a few are worthy of mention. At Casterly Rock, Lady Joanna Lannister set aside her war with the Iron Men long enough to write the Hand and point out that her daughters Cyrelle and Tyshara were maidens of noble birth and marriageable age. The twice-widowed Lady of Storm's End, Elinda Baratheon, put forward her own daughters, Cassandra and Ellen. Cassandra had once been betrothed to Aegon II and was well prepared to serve as queen, she wrote. From White Harbour came a raven from Lord Torren, speaking of past marriage pacts between the dragon and the merman, broken by cruel chance, and suggesting that King Aegon might put things aright by taking a Manderley for his bride. Charis Footley, widow of Tumbleton, made so bold as to nominate herself. Perhaps the boldest letter came from the irrepressible Lady Samantha of Oldtown, who declared that her sister Sansara, of House Tarly, is spirited and strong and has read more books than half the maesters in the Citadel, whilst her good sister Bethany, of House Hightower, was very beautiful, with smooth, soft skin and lustrous hair in the sweetest manner, though also lazy and somewhat stupid, truth be told, though some men seem to like that in a wife. She concluded by suggesting that perhaps King Aegon should marry both of them, one to rule beside him, as Queen Alysanne did, King Jaehaerys, and one to bed and breed. And in the event that both of them were found wanting for whatever obscure reason, Lady Sam helpfully appended the names of 31 other nubile maidens from houses Hightower, Redwine, Tarly, Ambrose, Florent, Cobb, Costain, Beesbury, Varner, and Grimm, who might be as suitable as queens. Mushroom adds that her ladyship ended with a cheeky postscript that said, "I know some pretty boys as well, should his grace be so inclined, but I fear they could not give him heirs." But none of the other chronicles mentioned this effrontery, and her ladyship's letter has been lost. In the face of so much tumult, Lord Unwin was forced to think again. Though he remained determined to wed his daughter Myriel to the king, he had to do so in a way that would not provoke the lords whose support he needed. Bowing to the inevitable, he mounted the Iron Throne and said, "For the good of his people, his grace must take another wife, though no woman will ever replace our beloved Jehera in his heart. Many have been put forward for this honour, the fairest flowers of the realm. Whichever girl King Aegon weds shall be the Alysanne to his Jeheris, the Jonquil to his Florian. She will sleep by his side, birth his children, share his labours, soothe his brow when he is sick, grow old with him. It is only fitting, therefore, that we allow the king himself to make this choice. On Maiden's Day we shall have a ball, the like of which King's Landing has not seen since the days of King Viserys. Let the maidens come from every corner of the Seven Kingdoms and present themselves before the king, that his grace may choose the one best suited to share his life and love." And so the word went out, and a great excitement took hold of the court and city and spread out across the realm. From the Dornish marches to the wall, doting fathers and proud mothers looked at their nubile daughters and wondered if she might be the one. And every high-born maid in Westeros began to primp and sew and curl her hair, thinking, "Why not me? I might be the queen." Yet even before Lord Anwyn had ascended the Iron Throne, he had sent a raven to Starpike, summoning his daughter to the city. Though Maiden's Day was yet 3 moons away, his lordship wanted Myriel at court, in hopes that she might befriend and beguile the king, and thus be chosen on the night of the ball. That much is known. What follows now is rumour. For it was said that even as he awaited the arrival of his own daughter, Unwin Peak also set in motion sundry secret plots and plans designed to undermine, defame, distract, and besmirch those damsels he deemed his daughter's most likely rivals. The suggestion that Cassandra Baratheon had pushed the little queen to her death was heard again, and the misdeeds of certain other young maidens, real or imagined, became common gossip about court. Isabel Staunton's fondness for wine was bruited about, the tale of Eleanor Massey's deflowering was told and retold, Rosamond Darry was said to be concealing 6 nipples under her bodice, supposedly because her mother had lain with a dog, Lyra Hayford was accused of having smothered an infant brother in a fit of jealousy, and it was put about that the 3 Janes, Jane Smallwood, Jane Mouton, and Jane Merriweather, liked to dress in squire's garb and visit the brothels along the Street of Silk, to kiss and fondle the women there as if the 3 of them were boys. All these calumnies reached the king's ears, some from Mushroom's own lips, for the fool confesses to having been paid handsomely to poison Aegon III against these maids and others. The dwarf was much in his grace's company following the death of Queen Jehera. Though his japes could not dispel the king's gloom, they delighted Gaemon Palehair, so Aegon oft summoned him for the boy's sake. In his testimony, Mushroom says Tessario the Thumb gave him a choice between silver or steel, and, "To my shame, I bade him sheathe his dagger and seized that sweet fat purse." Nor were words the only means by which Lord Unwin sought to win his secret war for the king's heart, if the whispers can be believed. A groom was found abed with Tyshara Lannister not long after the ball had been announced. Though Lady Tyshara claimed the lad had climbed in her window uninvited, Grand Maester Munkin's examination revealed her maidenhead was broken. Lucinda Penrose was set upon by outlaws whilst hawking along Blackwater Bay, not half a day's ride from the castle. Her hawk was killed, her horse was stolen, and one of the men held her down whilst another slit her nose open. Pretty Philena Stokeworth, a vivacious girl of 8, who had sometimes played at dolls with the little queen, took a tumble down the serpentine steps and broke her leg, whilst Lady Buckler and both her daughters drowned when the boat that was carrying them across the Blackwater foundered and sank. Some men began to talk of a Maiden's Day curse, whilst others, wiser in the ways of power, saw unseen hands at work and held their tongues. Were the Hand and his minions responsible for these tragedies and misfortunes? Or were they happenstance? In the end it would not matter. Not since the reign of King Viserys had there been a ball of any sort in King's Landing, and this would be a ball like none other. At tourneys, fair maidens and high ladies vied for the honour of being named the Queen of Love and Beauty, but such reigns lasted only for a night. Whichever maid King Aegon chose would reign over Westeros for a lifetime. The Highborn descended on King's Landing from keeps and castles in every part of the Seven Kingdoms. In an effort to limit their numbers, Lord Peake decreed that the contest would be limited to maidens of noble blood under 30 years of age. Yet even so, more than 1,000 nubile girls crowded into the Red Keep on the appointed day, a tide far too great for the hand to stem. Even from across the sea they came. The Prince of Pentos sent a daughter, the Archon of Tyroche a sister, and the daughters of ancient houses set sail from Myre and even old Volantis, though, sadly, none of the Volantine girls ever arrived at King's Landing, being carried off by corsairs from the Basilisk Isles on the way. Each maid seemed lovelier than the last, Mushroom says in his testimony. Sparkling and spinning in their silks and jewels, they made a dazzling sight as they made their way to the throne room. It would be hard to picture anything more beautiful, unless perhaps all of them had arrived naked. One did, for all intents and purposes. Myrmidora Hayne, daughter of a magister of Lys, turned up in a gown of translucent blue-green silk that matched her eyes, with only a jewelled girdle underneath. Her appearance sent a ripple of shock through the yard, but the king's guard barred her from the hall until she changed into less revealing garb. No doubt these maidens dreamed sweet dreams of dancing with the king, charming him with their wit, exchanging coy glances over a cup of wine. But there was to be no dancing, no wine, no opportunity for conversation, be it witty or dull. The gathering was not truly a ball in the ordinary sense. King Aegon III sat atop the Iron Throne, clad in black, with a golden circlet round his head and a gold chain at his throat, as the maidens paraded beneath him, one by one. As the king's herald announced the name and lineage of each candidate, the girl would curtsy, the king would nod down at them, and then it would be time for the next girl to be presented. By the time the 10th girl was presented, the king had doubtless forgotten the first 5, Mushroom says. Their fathers could well have sneaked them back into the queue for another go-round, and some of the more cunning likely did. A handful of the braver maidens made so bold as to address the king in an attempt to make themselves more memorable. Ellen Baratheon asked his grace if he liked her gown. Her sister later put it about that her question was, "Do you like my breasts?" But there is no truth to that. Alyssa Royce told him she had come all the way from Runestone to be with him today. Patricia Redwine went her one better by declaring that her party had travelled from the Arbor and had thrice been forced to beat back attacks by outlaws. "I shot one with an arrow," she declared proudly. "In the arse." Lady Anya Weatherwax, aged 7, informed his grace that her horse's name was Twinklehoof, and she loved him very much, and asked if his grace had a good horse too. "His grace has 100 horses," Lord Unwin answered impatiently. Others ventured compliments about his city, his castle, and his clothes. A northern maid named Barbara Bolton, daughter of the Dreadfort, said, "If you send me home, your grace, send me home with food, for the snows are deep and your people are starving." The boldest tongue belonged to a Dornish woman, Moria Corgyle, of Sandstone, who rose from her curtsy, smiling, and said, "Your grace, why not climb down from there and kiss me?" Aegon did not answer her. He answered none of them. He gave each maid a nod to acknowledge that he had heard them. Then Sir Marston and the King's Guard saw them on their way. Music wafted over the hall all through the night, but could scarce be heard over the shuffle of footsteps, the din of conversation, and from time to time the faint, soft sound of weeping. The throne room of the Red Keep is a cavernous chamber, larger than any hall in Westeros save Black Heron's. But with more than 1,000 maids on hand, each with her own retinue of parents, siblings, guards, and servants, it soon became too crowded to move and suffocatingly hot, though outside a winter wind was blowing. The herald charged with announcing the name and lineage of each of the fair maidens lost his voice, and had to be replaced. 4 of the hopefuls fainted, along with 12 mothers, 7 fathers, and a septon. 1 stout lord collapsed and died. The Maiden's Day Cattle Show, Mushroom would name the ball afterward. Even the singers who had made so much of it beforehand found little to sing about as the event unfolded, and the king himself appeared ever more restless as the hours passed and the parade of maids continued. "All this," says Mushroom, "was just as the hand desired. Each time his grace frowned, shifted in his seat, or gave another weary nod, the likelihood of his choosing Lady Turnips increased, Lord Unwin reasoned. Mary Alpeak had arrived in King's Landing almost a moon's turn before the ball.